Chanting out and talking about the light and the darkness. Will it be you? Will it be me? Can we make it a common reality? Good morning, good afternoon, and maybe somewhere in the world, good evening. We're alive because we want to stay alive. In Torah Chaim, instructions of life. Torah Chesed, instructions of kindness. Torah Rachamim. This is now, I'm so happy to announce, this is the 301st class. We passed 300 and we're going further into the future with the blessing of the angel of the infinite creator. Soul class number 301, in search of ancient authentic Torah number 73. Blessings and greetings, blessed souls. We continue to vibe out on the book of Genesis, quote, and the man named his wife Eve because she was the mother of all life. What in the world is going on here? After the Ein Sof, the infinite creator, curses the primordial snake, rebukes original woman and original man. Original man suddenly comes up with a name for his wife? Question, why do we call them, as it's translated into English, from the original Lashon HaKodesh Hebrew, Adam and Eve, and not Adam and Steve? And why is the original couple of creation for the human family experience man and woman, not man and man, or woman and woman? And what is the connection between woman and the attribute of being the mother of all life and not father of all life? And by the way, those of you thinking, oh, Don Zusi is homophobic, I want to offer you a question later on the show, but it says how I am not homophobic, and the proof is from the Torah itself, why I am not allowed to be homophobic. As well, we hope to engage in discussions regarding the teachings of Rambam, Chabad, and Brez of Chassidus, the Book of Daniel, and concepts relating to Torah prophecy. Meanwhile, please, blessed souls, pray for peace and the removal of hatred and jealousy and all forms of competition, all forms of competition which are not needed and only undermine the unity of the human family experience. I'm so pleased and proud and honored to be joined by my co-host today, student, teacher, and advocate for the dissemination of the teaching of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Don, and to everybody who's going to be listening.
And also we also have Ben Noah scholar, Ron Williams. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Dennis. I'm Don.
Good morning, Ron.
It's been a long time since the three of us have come together, and I hope today we're going to be in the spirit of unity. And with being within the spirit of unity, I want to give a caveat for all of you who are listening out there, whether live or you'll Bezat Hashem, with the help of the Most High, you'll hear the archive version. Anything that myself, Donzus Y. Goodman say, or Dennis Ryan, or Ron Williams say, are solely our individual opinions. We are not the masters of the Torah. We are not the prophets of the generation. We are activists for the empowerment of the human family experience. And anything I say, or Dennis says, and Ron says, is our own opinions. We have differences of opinions. Sometimes you'll hear them. But it's not that we should get into argumentation, but rather to show different views. So you, blessed souls listening in, will have, I think, a unique opportunity in today's show, Bezat Hashem, with the help of the Most High, to hear different opinions so you can do your own research and come up with your own answer to the questions we might be raising in your mind, or maybe giving you an answer to a question you might have had, and as well, hopefully, last but not least, to empower you to make it a better world. That's the purpose of this show, to energize and hopefully empower not just ourselves, but those who are listening, to make it a world as a suitable vessel for the coming of the Mashiach, the Messiah. And speaking of an issue which I think is very important to talk about, and we'll start off the show with this. This Erev Shabbos, this Friday afternoon, on my way back to Kesekron Heights, I stopped up at a store, and I saw, I think it was the Daily News, which is a newspaper, which is popular in New York City, an announcement was made that the family of Nelson Mandela, who, as I understand, as of this moment, 9:37 Eastern Standard Time here live on Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, is still alive. But the family was opting to take him off the respirator, which was helping him to stay alive. And immediately I had a ill feeling, and I, with all due respect to the Mandela family or those who are involved in the process of deciding whether he should be taken off the life support system that he's on, he is ailing from a severe lung infection, which has been plaguing him, I think, for the last month. And I said to myself, wait a minute. We of Israel have a historical precedent that the prophet Isaiah had rebuked the king Hezekiah, Cheskiah HaMelech, that he should just wait for his death. And Hezekiah said to Isaiah, finish your prophecy and leave me. This is from the oral Torah tradition, from the Talmud tractate in Brachos, blessings. He said, finish your prophecy and go, because we have a tradition in the house of David and Solomon, who he was a direct descendant of, Hezekiah the king, that even when the sword is to the side of one's neck, one should not give up hope. And therefore, I, Donzus Y. Goodman, as just one human being at the other end of the world from South Africa, offer up an impassioned plea for anyone hearing right now to offer up a prayer for Nelson Mandela, that the Most High Creator of all creation of heaven and earth should in fact heal him, and it should be recognized, not because we're doing it, but because we're calling upon to give testimony that Hashem is Rofei Kol Basar, the healer of all flesh. And I'd like to start off by reading chapter 20, which is a traditional psalm that we read in Israel for anyone who's sick, whoever that person may be. I'd like to read it. Then we're going to go to Dennis and Ron on their feedback on my opening statement. For the conductor, a psalm by David. May the Lord answer you on the day of distress. May the name of the God of Jacob fortify you. May he send you help from the sanctuary and support you from Zion. May he remember all your offerings and also accept favorably your sacrifices. May he grant your heart's desire and fulfill your every counsel. We will rejoice in your deliverance and raise our banners in the name of our God. May the Lord fulfill all your wishes. Now I know that the Lord has delivered his anointed one, answering him from his holy heavens, from the mighty saving power of his right hand. Some rely upon chariots and some upon horses, but we rely upon and invoke the name of the Lord our God. They bend and fall, but we rise and stand firm. Lord, deliver us. May the King answer us on the day we call. Adonai Hoshia HaMelech Yanenu Vayom Kurenu. Dennis, your thoughts on these matters and how... Is it logical for me to call out to implore other human beings, all blessed and anointed with the divine image, to pray that God heal Nelson Mandela in defiance of the family and even perhaps the doctor's recommendations he be taken off the life support systems?
We humans have limitations, and God created Earth with limitations. There's two categories. We call it humans, and we call it vegetables. We do not try to convert vegetables into humans, because the design is different. Likewise, to relegate a human into a vegetable state is going against the design of the Creator. So we're in a dilemma here. We want to help people, pray for them mentally and physically, but at the same time, if we're reducing them to a vegetable status, it's going against the design. And that's where the limitation comes in. We can only do so much because we're in God's hands.
Ron, your take on the family's decision, and again, I don't know if it's taking place, but I saw this Friday afternoon that... there was a decision that was being planned to take him off the respirator. Your comments on that, and how? What do you think? You think I'm being logical, or maybe super logical, or irrational, or rational by advocating we all pray around the world for the speedy healing from Almighty God to Nelson Mandela?
Most of my knowledge of Nelson Mandela came when I was living at the time in Guyana, South America, when most of his activities were at that point in time highlighted. He's been a symbol of the freedom against the opposition against apartheid in South America, in South Africa. So he has become that symbolical figure around the world. And so praying for his recovery, I think it would be in place. But also, many times families are given the opportunity in the beginning before a person is placed on this respirator. I mean, they should be given this opportunity to decide whether or not to place them on it. Because once they place them on that respirator, taking them off that is tantamount of murder. You basically... taking their life now. So on one side, you put them on a respirator to keep them going, and then another side, you decide to take them off and basically kill them. So I think we just have to adjust the entire procedure from the beginning so the families would make the choice whether or not to have them placed on it, because once they're on it, they really don't have that choice anymore of taking them off.
Mm-hmm. You say, from your own personal opinion, or as it relates to the seven Noahide commandments?
Actually, as it relates to the seven Noahide commandments in Mordecai, the book of the Divine Code by Rabbi Wiener.
Right. So I would agree from my understanding as well. I mean, there are certain mitigating circumstances, but I do believe. I mean, and I've mentioned this more than once in our radio series, gentlemen. And for you, those of you out there, blessed souls listening in 1993, there was a defensive tackle, a defensive end for the New York Jets. His name was Dennis Byrd. Maybe you remember that, Dennis. You might not remember this, Ron. I don't even know if you're a football fan. Or Dennis, you might just, as someone who follows the media, that there was some sort of severance in his upper spinal cord that rendered him paralyzed. Now, the doctors had not decreed upon him, and no doctor should decree what will be, because God ultimately is the one who decrees that he would be paralyzed. At that point, I believe the family of Dennis Byrd, and I think his wife, he was married, I believe he's still alive, made an impassioned plea to ask for people living in the American continent to pray for his healing. And lo and behold, people prayed for him all over the country. And I'm not saying he had a full healing, but he went from being diagnosed as being paralyzed to this day, if he's still alive, I heard a year afterwards, he was up and around and walking. Now, how do you like that? The doctors have pronounced him likely or definitely going to be paralyzed the rest of his life, and he was up and walking a year later. So I say that here's a man that suffered and languished in jail for 27 years under the evil apartheid rulership, dictatorship, whatever you want to call it, and eventually became the leader of that country. I think that he has the merits that if people all around would pray for his healing, and that healing should be in a way that he himself should realize that it's people's prayers. I'm sure he would become an advocate for prayer. And if we can accomplish this as to partner with all the good peoples, good-spirited human souls of the world, hopefully this will start a tidal wave, a tsunami of prayer to bring about healings, more peace, brotherhood, sisterhood, humanhood, to empower the human family experience. And by the way, I just want to mention, it is a Torah commandment that we should pray for what we need. And I think we need, what I humbly suggest, and I'll pass the ball back to Dennis and Ron, is that I humbly suggest that we all need to see the efficacy, the potency, the power of prayer to Almighty God to heal all flesh, in order that will encourage others to keep on praying more and more and more until we find ourselves praying in the middle of the complete and true redemption under the leadership of the Messiah, the Lion of Judah, who will roar out Torah Chadasha, revealed in matters of Torah that will be accessible to every human being freely, like the air we breathe. Dennis, your take on this matter.
Prayer is very, very powerful. God is the controller of everything. So if you're praying to the controller, might he do something about it? We even pray for that. So when we're in God's hands and we hope for the best, because he will consider everything more than humans can even look at and come up with a solution. And that's what we must accept.
Mm-hmm. Ron, your take on these matters.
The fact that prayer is basically the definition of our faith in the Creator. What it does is it brings a sanctification of His name in this world. Whenever we offer prayer, we ask to pray on others' behalf for them. And basically, many times we see that outcome. It's very overt, sometimes not. But nevertheless, there are no prayers that go unheard. And if it's not answered immediately, there may be mitigating circumstances which we are not aware of. But nevertheless, mm-hmm. prayer is a direct definition of our faith and belief in the Creator. So it's basically advised in every single circumstance. And even as Noahites, we have the prayer for the recovery of a sick person, which we call upon the merciful God to restore health, and to cure, to strengthen, to invigorate the person. And we call it in the name of the God, the Creator of each and every one of us.
Okay, beautiful. Gentlemen, before we turn to Dennis to share with us the wisdom of Rambam, I saw this on Shabbos in the famous Frankel Shul. And by the way, I want to remind everyone, we heard A Light in the Darkness by Blessed Brother, Armed Spirit and Soul, Isaac Batone, who's still jamming away. And I want to thank you, Rabbi Isaac, for allowing me to play that music, A Light in the Darkness. The idea of doctors pronouncing someone doomed to die, heaven forbid, may we never know of this, is something which I was told many years ago when I was working in a bookstore, a Jewish bookstore, and an Orthodox Jewish nurse told me that she had consulted with a rabbi, saying that actually doctors are not allowed to make such prognosis. Of course, they can be. No one's saying doctor can be Pollyannish. They can say there's a chance of this, there's a chance of that, but ultimately the role of a doctor is to heal, not to pronounce who will die and who will live. Of course, we encourage doctors to promote the idea that someone will make it through a procedure, a sickness, a disease, an illness, a traumatic injury. But this is under the category I think when doctors say, well, this is what's going to happen, the person will die, this is in the realm of trying to be a sophisticated, modern, medicinal fortune teller. And this article I picked up, I think, ties in with this, what we started off the show with, and I'll read it as follows and get Dennis and Ron's feedback. Nearly every human society reserves a special respect for those who claim to be able to predict the future. The fortune-telling professions run the gamut from witches and astrologers and shamans to meteorologists, physicians, and other scientists. The tools they employ have become more increasingly sophisticated. We've progressed, I don't know if we've progressed, but we've morphed from bones and crystal balls to space satellites and complex mathematical models. However, at the root is the same human drive to keep anxiety at bay and gain some measure of control over the unknown. Expectancy, and that word expectancy was put in quotation marks, is the scientific term for our beliefs about the future and how those beliefs affect our behavior. Any decision from the mundane to the most complex depends on us having some sort of idea about what the future holds. For example, I might plan my dinner tonight around what vegetables are in season, what is on sale in the store, and if the weather is hot or cold. Expectancy also influences far-reaching decisions such as how to invest money, what type of job to train for, and whom to marry. Researchers of expectancy affects distinguish between forecasts or predictions of the future that we are reasonably certain will happen and hope for, which are desirable future events which may or may not happen. Whenever we work towards any goal, we use a combination of both these expectancies. First, we envision the future that we desire. Then we figure out the steps we need to take to get there in practical and predictable manners. Or, in the Torah terminology, Sof Masba Machshava Techila, the final action is what we had in mind to begin with. We need to go through countless steps to get to our final destination, the one we had in mind to begin with. However, in order to reach our destination, we need several things. We need a clear concept of where are we going, and we need to be reasonably confident that we will get there. Only then can we plan and take the actions needed to bring our fruits to action. There is a well-known Hasidic expression, which is cited almost frequently somewhere around the world by Lubavitch Hasidim, and I think by other Hasidim, and hopefully by non-Hasidim, Trach gut wird sein gut, think good and it will be good. This is not some ode or magical chanting. Rather, it reflects the most current scientific thinking. Positive thinkers are able to achieve more than pessimistic, quote-unquote, realistic thinkers. Their positive experiences give them the energy needed to overcome any obstacle in their path. When God created the world, the Creator had a destination in mind. The destination of a dwelling in the lower worlds, he gave us the privilege of being his partners in creation. Our faith and commitment to this project has kept us through seemingly insurmountable trials and hurdles. We are approaching the time when it will no longer be just a hope or wish. The dreams of generations about to come to fruition with the revelation of the Messiah and the final redemption. Dennis, fortune tellers, what's it all about?
Humans will all die. That's a given. If somebody wants to say they know what the future is, then they're guessing or they're giving an opinion. If a doctor says, oh, you're going to die in 3 weeks or something like that, that's his opinion. It's a human opinion. It could be a scientific opinion, but that doesn't obviate the need for God in there. However, that's why people say, oh, I better go get a second opinion or a third opinion or a fourth opinion. Now, if you had 500 opinions, would that make any difference as to what's going to happen tomorrow? That is our human dilemma, is that we cannot see the future. And the main point of this whole thing is not magic. The only humans that ever said anything about the future were the prophets. Those prophets were speaking God's words through a human mouth. So that is the only time that there's been a variation in the history of man that somebody talked about tomorrow with a certain amount of certainty. And even today, people will debate it. But there's no human, without any help of God, that can predict what's going to happen tomorrow or the day after or the day after. We cannot look for false hope. It depends on how much faith and belief you have that God will make tomorrow a good place.
Beautiful. Ron, you're taken to their fortune telling, and do people have the right to say what will be if they're not exactly sure on the prophetic level what will be? Or is it better for them to invest in thinking positively?
My personal take on that would be basically a lack of faith in the Creator, and you're transferring that belief into the, either may it be science, or to those who proclaim to know the destiny of man, to the reading of the stars. I mean, I'm not taking away all validity from astrology, but in our day, understanding it and just, you know, making money on people who, you know, are very culpable, that's a different story. And I think these days what happened is it became more of a money-making thing than actually helping people, because even in the Talmud, there are stories where, in the case of Rabbi Akiva, a fortune teller in the marketplace told him that his daughter would die in a day for marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought about this until the day for marriage, but he didn't. The thing is, he didn't act upon it because he knows that everything is in the hand of the Creator. And due to some kind act in which she performed that same day, she lived through her marriage. So See that even though there are certain things written in the zodiac and the stars, we have an ability to change that. Sometimes knowing it, if we have that strong belief in the Creator and change, we're able to avert the outcome. But many of us, if we're not on that level of belief and faith in the Creator, we may be doomed by this and just look forward to this happening, which will actually bring about its revelation. So it's a very tricky thing. And I really would rather not even hear what they have to say, because regardless of what we might call our faith system is, we may lend a certain dependency on what they've said, and it denies our belief in the Creator. Oh, one more thing I just have to have in the divine code dealing with the euthanasia and murder, it says that there's a difference in terms of being brain dead and heart. The heart that has been completely stopped. It's the difference between of opinion also, because many people go according to brain dead, and once the heart is still beating, the person is considered dead. And according to Torah, it goes according to the heart. The heart is still beating, and once a person has been placed on a respirator and their heart continues to beat, you're not able to take them off of that respirator. What's the heart still beating?
Well, Nelson Mandela has a lung infection, and according to the Torah outlook, is that the heart is considered to be chatzoni salev, the exterior part of the heart, because the respiration takes place there. So that seemed to indicate that they should not, according to what you're sharing with us, Ron, they should not take him off the respirator.
Right.
Okay. Very good. Now, speaking of a positive thinker, and I just want to mention as well, Blessed Souls, if you want to chime in and speak with Ron or Dennis or make any comments, questions, concerns about what we're talking about, you can call in at 1-347-838-8669. That's 1-347-838-8669. At this point, we're going to segue to Dennis Ryan to share with us the wisdom of that positive thinker and certainly not a Pollyannish human being, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides, the Rambam. Dennis? What will you share with us today, sir?
We're going to read page 261 from the Guide for the Perplexed. And at the top of the page is, man can control his passions. And last session I ended with the sentence of, the station of man varies according to the exercise of his power. And I'll continue from that sentence. And this is the words of Maimonides. Some persons constantly strive to choose that which is noble and to seek perpetuation in accordance with the direction of their nobler part. Their form, their thoughts are engaged in formation of ideas, the acquisition of true knowledge about everything, and the union with the divine intellect which flows down upon them, and which is the source of man's form. Whenever they are led by wants of the body to that which is low and avowed disgraceful, they are grieved at their position. They feel ashamed and confounded at their situation. They try with all their might to diminish this disgrace and to guard against it in every possible way. They feel like a person whom the king is his anger ordered to refuse from one place to another in order to put him to shame. That person tries as much as possible to hide himself during the time of his disgrace. He perhaps removes a small quantity a short distance in which a manner that his hands and garments remain clean, and he himself is unnoticed by his fellow men. Such would be the conduct of a free man. Whilst a slave would find pleasure in such work, he would not consider it a great burden, but throw himself into the refuse, smear his face and his hands, carry the refuse openly, laughingly, and singingly. This is exactly the difference in the conduct of different men. Some consider, as we have just said, all wants of the body as shame and disgrace and defect to which they are compelled to attend. This is chiefly the case which the sense of touch, which is a disgrace to us, according to Aristotle, and which, in the cause of our desire for eating, drinking, and sensuality, intelligent persons must, as much as possible, reduce these wants, guard against them, feel grieved when satisfying them, attain from speaking of them, discussing them, and attending to them in the company with others. Man must have control over all these desires, reduce them as much as possible, and only retain of them which is indispensable. His aim must be the aim of man as man. Example, the formation of ideas and nothing else. The best and sublimest among them is the idea which man forms of God, angels, and the rest of creation according to his capacity. Such men are always with God, and of them it is said, ye are princes, and all of you are children of the Most High. Psalms 32-6. This is man's task and purpose.
Dennis, it's hard for me personally, I'll just say hopefully in the next show you read more of it, and this is the type of teaching that people hopefully will look inside themselves and see how it applies to them and where they can strengthen themselves in that aspects of their persona that needs strengthening, and to weaken those aspects of their persona that need weakening. Ron, any comments on this seminal teaching from Rambam, from the Guide of the for the Perplexed?
No, actually, I just in agreement with what you just said.
Okay, with that being said, gentlemen, we're at our more than a halfway point, and I'd like to take our traditional music break. You know, blessed souls, we have this idea. I think all of us would like to see revolution, which the type of revolution will mean the evolution of human consciousness and spirit. You know, we just passed by July 4th, which is the celebration of the revolution against the monarchy of the Kingdom of England in those days, 237 years ago. There have been many revolutions that have taken place. And here, of course, and I just want to make a parenthetical statement. Anyone who knows me knows that Donzo Sigubin loves reggae. We're talking about the righteous reggae. Here's some righteous reggae by Dennis Brown, who asks a question and kind of answers it in part What type of revolution do you want to be a part of? Well, this is the type of revolution Dennis Brown is promoting in this song from, I think it's the late 70s or early 80s. And it's the type of revelation revelation, that was a Freudian slip, but I guess maybe it was really something that my divine image wanted me to communicate. This is the type of revelation I want to be involved in. I hope you do too. Bless those. Please listen in, and then we'll go back to the last part of our show, or the second half. And that was Dennis Brown, Revolution, or maybe we should change the song to Revelation, the revelation of brotherhood, the revelation of positive thoughts, because the revolution, the revelation shall be spurred on by every thought, one positive thought at a time. Blessed souls, I'd like to go on to sharing, which I think hopefully will be the beginning of many insightful teachings by Rabbi Dr. Zev Balin, who lives in Jerusalem. He is a Breslover Chosid, and he consented to me sharing these teachings. This is a teaching from the Breslov perspective, of Breslov Chassid's anger management. I'd like to read it, and again, we'll start with Ron, there's some feedback, and then we'll ask for Dennis's feedback as well. It goes like this. In the beginning, the world was completely black and devoid of God, and yet when God said, let there be light, the light of the first day began to shine. When we were slaves in Egypt, we lived under the worst conditions that ever existed. We worshipped idols and sunk to the 49th level of impurity, according to Oral Torah tradition. Yet the Almighty Creator still saw the little bit of good in us, which was enough for Him to redeem us. At midnight in a second, the Most High ended the Egyptian exile and took us out to freedom. Fast forwarding into the history of the nation of Israel, every night at midnight, in one second, a north wind came and blew through the strings of King David's harp, awakening him from his deepest sleep to serve the Most High Creator like a lion all night long. Don't wait until the next time that someone provokes you and you're tempted to vent your anger on that person. You can work on it now in the most existential sense, and in the future you will only need 1 second to be completely ready to deal with it. So Rabbi Dr. Balin gives the following 11 simple tip process. Number one, imagine someone is provoking you. Number two, see yourself stopping and take a deep breath. 3. Cry out to God, actually or mentally, to save you and redeem you from this test. 4. Breathe in and imagine the Almighty Creator has given you the hope that you need. 5. Breathe out and imagine that the Almighty Creator has taken away your despair. Number 6. Breathe in and imagine that the Creator has already given you the strength that you need. Number 7. Breathe out and imagine that the Creator has taken away your weakness. Point number 8, breathe in and imagine that the Creator has already given you the purity that you need. Number 9, breathe out and imagine that the Creator has taken from you all impurity. Number 10, breathe in and imagine that the Creator has already given you the happiness that you need. Point number 11, last but not least, breathe out and imagine that the Creator has taken away all your sadness. And Rabbi Dr. Balin concludes, promise yourself that you deserve to practice this exercise many more times. Then when and if you are tested in the future, you will be ready to meet the challenge, for the Creator will have prepared your salvation in advance. In 1 second, you will be able to stop and see with clarity that to let your anger out will only result in your regretting it later on. You will succeed in staying calm. Dearest friends, I made a short video clip of this meditation, which I called In 1 Second, to help you practice. Look at it on Breslov, Breslev.coil, or you can go to Rabbi Dr. Zev Balin's blog spot, which I want to promote it now, and you can access it by going to Zev, Zevballen, .blogspot.com, and then you'll have a smorgasbord of not just articles but videos that Rabbi Dr. Zev Balin has promoted. And he has been in practice in psychotherapy for over 30 years with approbations and of many leading rabbis and people within the secular field as well. Ron, the idea of reducing our anger, I think that's also an expression of faith. Your take on this point of view?
First of all, I'd like to ask Dennis, that portion of Rambam you just read was from the Guide of the Perplexed?
Yeah, Dennis, that was from the Guide of the Perplexed you read from, right?
Directly.
Yes, okay. Ron, it was from the Guide of the Perplexed.
I'd like to read that portion, but unfortunately I don't have a copy of the Guide to Perplexed. In terms of back to your question, reducing anger.
Yeah.
Actually, there have been many books were written on the detriments of anger, and one of the most remarkable comments on anger was that Moses forgot some of the procedures according to the Torah, according to the commandments of God, and he became angry. And it says that a person's soul, the actual soul that contains the wisdom that they've acquired, leaves them, and a foreign soul enters them. That's why the reason they can't remember the words of Torah that they studied. So not only are we, you know, experiencing a kind of a possession, because in a state of anger, people do things that they normally wouldn't even do, and even after they've displayed that behavior, many times they're surprised at themselves. And it's because that, you know, they've been possessed by, you know, external, the spirit of anger actually is an external to us. So it's a very serious, and it needs working on, and we all have our ways in which we try to cope with it. So, I'm sorry, guys, I've been trying to get online to read what you just said and to get what Dennis just said, so I'm a little bit off here.
Okay, no problem. Dennis, your take on these matters. Anger management, is it connected to reaffirming one's faith, or when one loses it, are we losing a little bit of our faith at that moment?
No, I don't think it's a question of faith. It's a question of your mental position. Where are you? Where is your mind? Are you controlling your body? Are you in control of your emotions? You can do it. God can help you to do it. But it centers on the human. And since we're imperfect and we are sentient animals, so to speak, we rely on our senses. So when something disturbs us, it sets off a trigger. We got to control that. And that's what Rambam was basically talking about. Men can control their passions. Anger is a type of passion. Why? Because you cut out all your analytical thinking when you get mad, because you're concentrating on thinking. If you want to be a more sane person, a calmer person, you should be thinking of love and peace. If you keep thinking of love and peace, then angry is way down at the bottom of the list. So if you want to degrade yourself and go down to near the bottom of the list where angry is, with hate and all sorts of crimes that can evolve from that, you are putting your mind in the wrong position. You should be thinking of a higher level, love and peace. If everybody controlled their passions by measuring it against love and peace before they respond, you would see a nicer world, a more agreeable world, as opposed to make an immediate decision based on your own personal trigger. Now, the breathing can work, and it has worked in some places, because it's easier to breathe than to let a whole bunch of junk come out of your mouth. So if you breathe and think, you can be a better human. Why? Because you're controlling your passions, as Maimonides calls it, I call it emotions. They're the same thing. We must control that variation in our body that has triggers to it, because the real trigger is God, and that is based on love and peace. If you put your mind in the right place, you should react the best way.
Beautiful, Dennis. Ron, any counter-response, or we'll move on?
No, thank you. I'm trying to just access what you just, because once I don't, I forget everything afterwards. Rabbi Yosef Balin?
Balin.
Thank you so much.
Well, we do have the archive version, and that's why, you know, because a lot of these concepts, even for myself, whenever we do a show, I do try during the week, even though it seems like I'm being pulled in different directions with all of my responsibilities, I do try to listen to any show I do to review it, and then I can make some mental notes, and I can, you know, hopefully get some more nourishment. And that is one of the things that,
is encouraged within a Torah observant lifestyle, whether you be Jewish or one of the blessed children of Noah, is to review teachings. I mean, we never get tired of drinking water. We never get tired of inhaling air. We never get tired of digesting our food. And if we can perceive, if we choose to, that the matters of Torah are spiritual nourishment, well, we should review that source of nourishment. I just dropped the phone. Yes, yes, Dennis.
Well, the Maimonides also preached indirectly that that we must be open-minded, because if we're open-minded, we can accept things. That doesn't mean we accept bad things, but we can accept things. But the other part of the preaching of Maimonides is that things change, and you must adjust to the change, because you've got to know where you were and where you're going. You don't jump into change unless you figure it out. So you must be open-minded and open to change.
Amen. And hopefully we're reviewing that idea of being open-minded and open to change. Now, blessed souls, we're going to move on to a plucking generously from a wonderful work by Rabbi Chaim Miller, the Slager edition, about the 13 principles of faith as it relates to the 6th and 7th principles relating to prophecy. And we've dealt with these matters before, and I guess you'd have to go back to several archive versions to get the earlier levels, because we're going to talk about now the 4th through 11th level of prophecy, which is rooted in the teachings of Rambam, guess where? From the Guide for the Perplexed. So continuing on, we see that there's a fourth, Rambam had delineated 11 levels of prophetic experience. And the fourth level is where the prophet hears in a prophetic dream something clearly and distinctly, but he does not see the speaker. And this was experienced by Samuel the prophet, Shmuel HaNavi, at the beginning of his prophetic mission. Now, the fifth level of prophecy is that a person addresses the prophet in a dream, as it was the case with some of the prophecies of Ezekiel, Yechezkel, as noted in chapter 40, verse 4, in Ezekiel, quote, "And the man spoke to me, saying, Son of man." So here, Ezekiel, the prophet, was spoken to prophetically by a man in a dream. In the sixth level of prophecy, Ramban lists that an angel speaks to a person in a dream, and this applies to most of the prophets. The seventh level of prophecy is in a prophetic dream. It appears to the prophet as if God had spoken to that person. At the eighth level, something presents itself to the prophet in a prophetic vision. He or she can see allegorical figures, such as were seen by Abraham in the vision, quote, of Between the Pieces, which you can learn about more by going to the book of Genesis 15, verse 9, for it was a vision by daytime as clearly stated. The next level of prophecy, the ninth level the Rambam writes about, is that the prophet hears words in a vision, as with Abraham in chapter 15, verse 4 in the book of Genesis, the word of God came to him saying, "This will not be your heir." At the 10th level of prophecy, the prophet sees a man again that speaks to him in a prophetic vision, such as with Abraham in the plain of Mamre in Genesis 18, verse 1, and with Joshua, Yehoshua, in Jericho in the book of Joshua, chapter 5, verses 13 through 19. Now, at the 11th level, he sees an angel that speaks to him in a vision, as was the case when Abraham was addressed by the angel at the sacrifice of Isaac Yitzhak, Genesis 22:15. This I hold to be, if we exclude Moses, Moshe, the highest degree that a prophet can attain. So, I'm sure, Dennis, you have encountered this teaching before. Rambam taking that bold step to actually delineate, which we've gone now, we went into eight levels of prophecy, that there was, I'm sure there was a certain courage that the Rambam had to bring out, because he was basically explaining the system, not relegating to the realm of mysticism or the unknown or the secrets, but rather something that people could start to categorize in their mind, that it should make sense to a human mind. Any comments on your part, Dennis, about this?
Yes, I thought I was a smart person till I read The Guide to the Perplexed. And I thought I knew something about prophecy until I read what Maimonides wrote. He took several chapters on this. And I finally understood after I read it, because this is a compound, complex, confusing subject. Why? Very simply, it brings in the ideas of God and the ideas of man together. Now, how can you do that? You don't send an email, you don't send a text, and you don't whisper in people's ears. What you do is you try to get individuals who can impress other individuals with what they say so that it sounds like that it is something that you cannot refute or disagree with. So here we have a methodology that was created on, let's say, a supernatural basis to try to influence humans to stay on the right track. Condemning to hell, not condemning them to hell, but trying to put them on the right track so they can get to heaven. So how do you do this? Maimonides broke it down not only by the humans involved, by the messages, but also by the delivery. To do that, he had to review every possible thing that was written in Scripture regarding prophecy. And nobody prior to him really took it as a separate subject. But we have a lot to learn and to understand from this. It is not simple, it is not easy, but it's very, very meaningful.
Thank you, Dennis. I am humbled by your words because I, too, was under the mistaken that maybe I was a smart guy, but when you come into contact with Rambam's teachings, whether it be the Guide to the Perplexed or Mishneh Torah or the other works of Rambam, one is quickly humbled by realizing, you know, there are some human beings who know more than us, who are more connected to God than us, and it'd be well suited for our spiritual, intellectual, emotional development to humble ourselves to these wisdoms and hopefully integrate them and have the great merit, as you are doing, hopefully are doing as well, to share these teachings with other people. Ron, the idea of delineating prophecy, I mean, it isn't just, you know, God spoke to the prophet, we have to do what the prophet says, or is there a great benefit for us to learn that there are various distinctive levels of prophecy? What is your take on this?
First of all, I have to poke some fun at you and Dennis. You guys are smart in comparison to me.
I don't know about that.
That's not a vote that you can take, Ron.
Because we'll both take a vote against your suggestion, Ron. Dennis and I will vote against that.
And the thing is, the comparison, I don't think it's fair, because Rambam wrote his work on the divine inspiration, and that's on a whole different level from being smart or wise, according
right.
to what we encounter these days. And he brought it out to a level where we can understand it now. And we really needed that, because we really wanted to understand what was happening. And thanks to Rambam, you know, and that divine inspiration that she acquired, we're able to understand it even better. But I have not read it much on prophecy, so I rather not make comments on it too much.
Okay. So
Don,
we'll go first. Yes, Dennis.
I treat the prophecy as suggestions, but they're from God, just like the Ten Commandments are suggestions, but it came from God. Now, is that a suggestion you can accept or reject? It comes from God.
Yep. Well, and you know, Rambam, in the Laws of the Foundation of the Torah, in the 7th chapter, I believe, wants us to know that, by the way, it is a fundamental principle in Torah that God, the Almighty Creator, communicates to us through the agency of prophecy. Now, we haven't had for a long time, a couple thousand years, whatever, give or take, 100 years, whatever, it's been a while since we've had people walking around officially recognized as prophets, in the sense that we read in the Tanakh and the five books of Moses and other works that have emanated into creation. People are called prophets. They, social prophets, visionary prophets, fine. I don't have a problem with that. But when in the context of a Torah prophet, we just don't see that today. However, if we understand that the Almighty Creator, who is eternal, gave an instruction which hopefully we will come to realize and internalize, that that instruction, although it might have been a couple thousand years ago, is for us in this day, we're all the more wiser and hopefully all the more humbled by the fact that we are getting the chance to get access openly to prophetic instruction and see how we can integrate it into our most mundane activities of eating and drinking and partnering with other human beings, hopefully in a peaceful and pleasant manner. That being said, gentlemen, and blessed those listening out there, I'd like to segue now to one verse from the book of Daniel, from chapter 1, verses 6, that it reads as follows. Among them, last week we talked about how Nebuchadnezzar had made sure that the youth, the Jewish youth come from the house of Judah, would be provided with the finest foods, that they would be able to stand before the king as Nebuchadnezzar's ministers. Now, verse 6 reads, among them from the children of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, these were all direct descendants of someone we mentioned earlier in the program, of Hezekiah, the king of Judah. And Nebuchadnezzar, by drawing from Hezekiah's descendants, he was fulfilling a prophecy that was made by the Navi Agula, the prophet of redemption, prophet Isaiah, Yeshayahu, in chapter 39, verse 7, in the book of Isaiah, quote, and of your sons that will issue from you, this was Isaiah speaking to Hezekiah, they will take away and they will be officials in the palace of the king of Babylon. Now, it's very interesting, with that being said, once they had been taken into the house of Nebuchadnezzar, they were actually given different names, actually idolatrous names, which has historically been the nature of those of one nation conquering another, to redefine even the very name calling of the individuals who would now be in servitude, and even the land. Two examples is in the common era after the destruction of the first temple, a Roman emperor had conquered, I believe it was Hadrian, please correct me if I'm wrong, either one of you gentlemen, who renamed Judea as Palestine. Hence, from that point on, it has been called Palestine, but those who want to call it Palestine, to the exclusion of recognizing that it is really the land of Israel. Yes, there was in ancient times a strip on the eastern coast called the Philistine land, which also went out a little bit easterly, southern easterly, into the land of Israel, when there were various conflicts in the time of David, and before him and after him with the Philistines. Also, we have, and one of the reasons why I mentioned that we're broadcasting live, not just from Kessler Crown Heights, but also from Turtle Island, is to recognize that the Native American Indians used to call this place Turtle Island, and you can learn more about that by Googling, whether it be Wikipedia. There's a long video, 50-minute video, why the American Indian called this place Turtle Island. But this is not any attempt to overthrow the American government, but the people should integrate some sort of sensitivity. You know, for myself, as a Jew living in the diaspora, I'm a citizen of the United States. I'm not here to burn my citizenship papers, but I do recognize that a people was conquered not in the spirit of the Seven Noahide Commandments, but rather with a spirit of cruelty. And I think for the last 400 years, there is a need to recognize this and to rectify it, hopefully to give more sovereignty, because unfortunately there have been over 180 treaties that have been broken with the Native American Indians, which is not in the spirit of the Noahide Commandments. And I do think will bring blessings to this country, not just to the American Indians, Native American Indians, but those of us who came from foreign shores to live in this land. With that being said, we'll turn to Dennis and Ron. Any comments, questions, or concerns you have about this matter? Dennis?
Well, you mentioned the Indians, Don. That opened up the door a bit. they were people who never had a Bible, yet they believed in Mother Nature. They believed
right.
in the spirituality of Mother Nature because they had nothing else. They didn't believe that man was going to do anything because they believed that Mother Nature was having control over the earth or the planet, which is true. But they believed there was spirituality in the wind. And everything that Mother Nature does, there's spirituality. So I can't fault the Indians for thinking the way they did, because they did the best they could with what they had. And without a Bible or any good book to lead you, you're going to come out with your own human thinking. So be that as it may. Now, could you repeat to me again what the question is regarding the subject matter that you just brought up, Don?
No, the idea that it has always been the nature of the conquering nation to not just, you know, to the peoples or the places they conquered, not only to recognize that they can, I didn't say it originally in my question, but I'll say it now, that it's always been the nature of the conquering nation to make use of the cream of the crop of the conquered peoples they have, you know, gained sovereignty over, at least in their own eyes, and eventually to go about changing their names to make a conscious attempt to disassociate them with their former cultures or perspectives or consciousness.
Well, that's because we don't want the new to look like the old. That's a normal human convention of changing things or imposing change, but what they're really doing is giving you what the old had, only with a new name. So we can relabel and relabel till infinity. Does it really change what we're doing from a human viewpoint? I mean, there's so many examples. When Alexander the Great conquered all those worlds, he told them, I want you to keep on doing what you're doing. And they said, yes, Alexander, we'll do it in your name. So it didn't make any difference if he was there or not. They're going to do what they were doing. Prior to the end of World War II, Russian and American interests grabbed as many scientists from Germany as possible to salt them away and put them into their own inventory of things to do. They said, oh, it's not German anymore because we took what they were doing and we now call that process American. So humans have been doing this over and over and over, but we cannot let the wolf in sheep's clothing pretend that he's really a sheep.
True. Ron, before I make my final comment on this section, any comments, questions, concerns about the ideas that Dennis and I have been shooting across with each other or sharing with each other?
I think this, the changing of the names in particular, they try to disconnect you from your roots. As a result, it's a massive form of a psychological oppression, because in slavery we see the same thing. Slaves were renamed. You know, the African slaves taken to the lands of the Americas. And by disconnecting your name, you cannot actually trace your connection back to where you actually came from. We had a lot of East Indian indentured laborers that came from India, and they came with their names intact. As a result, they traced their lineage exactly back to where they came from, and there's a certain amount of national pride that they still have intact, as opposed to the Africans who came here and basically have no connection or to who they really are. And due to the fact of the lack of archives and all these things, you can't really trace your ancestry back anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is what the king, Nebuchadnezzar, done to kind of disconnect the sons of Judah, these Judean people he's conquered, from their ancestry.
True. Now, I just want to just conclude on this one before we get at this point, before we go into our last section of the show, is that we see something unique, though, from the Torah itself. Yes, we readily admit that the land of Israel had a name before it was called the land of Israel, because there were people that were living there called the Canaanites. Therefore, from prophetic Torah teachings, we of Israel shall never forget, and we will openly state that before it was called the land of Israel, it was called the land of Canaan. However, with that being said, and that's a prophetic teaching, it is the land of Canaan before it became the land of Israel. The Canaanites had been apportioned as the seed of Ham, they had been actually given the blessed portion of Africa. and they had made incursions over to the land of, I don't even know what you can call the land before it's the land of Canaan, and they had actually conquered our ancestors, the Semitic peoples, the Shemites, and therefore it was called Canaan because they had conquered the land. And I would be interested, perhaps this is something that only the Messiah will be able to reveal, or any prophets when they start to resurrect. What was the, and I have not learned that the land was called anything else before it was called the land of Israel, other than the land of Canaan. Perhaps there was a name, but actually the Canaanites were given by the prophet Noah after the flood, and he saw, because he lived it 350 years after that, the great deluge, which is actually the second deluge that had taken place. There had been a flood that had taken place in the times of Enosh, but that's for another show, that they were supposed to stay in Africa, but they made in and they conquered the land from the Semites, and therefore there's a certain secret reasoning which I cannot access yet why it's called Canaan, or the land of the Canaanites, but the Torah testifies Israel had conquered the land of Canaan. We do not deny for one moment that it was populated by the Canaanites after they had conquered our ancestors, the seed of Shem. Dennis or Ryan, any comments or questions before we move on to the last section?
Yes, in terms of history, we don't know all of history. We only know the remnants and things that people left behind, and we try to read into it. What we're doing is we're guessing and making judgments, but apparently we weren't privy to everything that happened since Adam and Eve. But there are important things that were written down, and we call it scripture. And that, to a certain extent, is how far we go. Other than that, everything is constantly being discovered. Just to give you an idea, the city of Rome stopped expanding their subway system. Why? Because every time they dug somewhere, they were finding some archaeological find. And that was costing them a fortune, not only to process it, but they were depriving the residents of the subway for today's world. So what happens is they just stopped because they didn't know where you should place your interest or your emphasis on the past or the future. But you got to remember, everything changes and we must adjust.
True. Ron, your thoughts on these matters?
I just wanted to clarify one thing, that the Hamite people who inhabited the land of Africa, they were not actually cursed with slavery. It was only Canaan.
That's right.
And in the book of Genesis, chapter 9, verse 10, chapter 9, verse 26, it said, "Blessed be God, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be a slave to them." So, and normally, whatever a slave might acquire, actually the acquisition of his master.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that Canaan was deemed with slavery on the Shem, that means the land that they actually acquired, which is the land of Israel, is actually an acquisition of the Shemite people who originally were given that portion of land. And
mm-hmm.
in the anthology, it stated that due to the fact that because of the actions of Canaan, Noah was unable to have any more children, and Shem had to be the one to take care of Noah, Canaan was given to him as a slave to help him to take care. That's why he's called a slave of slaves, because Shem
mm-hmm.
was now, not in terms of servant of his father in his old age, instead of Noah having any other children. As a result, Canaan became a servant of Shem. So, and the land specifically was divided to the Hamite people of Africa, and the Shemite people were given Asia, and the Middle East and Asia. So that land originally belonged to the Shemite people. And Canaan's portion was because of his servitude to Shem. That's why it was included in that portion.
So, and I just want to comment that Rambam himself states in Positive Mitzvah 187, in the book of mitzvahs, that in fact the Canaanite people, which were cursed to be enslaved, are actually an extinct people. They had mingled in with other tribes, whether it be African or Caucasian or Asian, and we cannot assume that just because they mixed in that the curse actually transferred. No, it did not. Therefore, any justification of, say in the Western Hemisphere, the last 400 years, which was started in the, according to Torah, it is not according to that type of slavery, is antithetical to the Torah. Any justification of the enslavement of the Africans and transporting them, separating themselves from their families in Africa, is totally against the spirit of the Torah, specifically within the seven Noahide commandments and the Torah itself. This whole idea of just breaking it, kidnapping, is actually one of the prohibitions connected to the seven Noahide commandments. So it's like an act of murder, basically. So anyone who has trouble dealing with this idea, don't debate me, blessed souls. Go debate the Rambam, who said the Canaanite people are an extinct people, a nation, the seven nations, and go work it on your own, do your own research, and realize that whatever took place with the slavery of the African last 400 years, and which is connected to the current social dysfunctionalities and problems that are not just in the West, but on the African continent, this is all because people wanted to interpret the Bible in a way to cause dysfunctionality upon the human family experience.
Don?
I probably ruffled a few feathers with that comment. Okay. Yes, Dennis.
Slavery is not good. Slavery is anti-human because we enslave animals to do our work and everything else that's on the planet. But to enslave other humans is contrary to design as to why humanity was created. In the Garden of Eden, there was no slaves. Everybody was equal, and they were told to go out and procreate. Humans created this condition of slavery, and it is not good.
Sure. That being said, Dennis and Ron and Dennis, we have about 14 minutes, but we might spill over a little bit because we have a little surplus time in our broadcasting airwaves here. Chapter 3, verse 20, and the man named his wife Eve because she was the mother of all life. So, again, what's going on here? They had just been rebuked, Adam and Eve, or actually Eve before Adam, and the snake, of course, was cursed. Basically, from the oral Torah tradition, there is a concept that Ein Muktam Mu'ucha B'Torah. Sometimes we see that there's not an orderly presentation of the teachings. This is according to the oral tradition with Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration transmitted to us by Moses down through the generations. And that actually this description of Adam all of a sudden calling his wife Eve or Chava was that she would be the mother of all living, meaning originally Eve's name before the sin was called Chaya. That the connotation of the word Chaya means like a lively entity, because a mother nurtures and gives life. But as well, this narrative, which is depicted in chapter 3, verse 20, is now returning to where it should have gone. But unfortunately, there was the digression or the tangential experience, unfortunately, of the first sin relating to the tree of knowledge, that Adam and Eve fell. So the Torah, Moses, was told by the Most High to record it in this fashion. That, you know, all things have to, sometimes we have to, when things are in motion, sometimes the locomotive must stop, even though the track seems clear, because there was a potent instruction relating to that original sin. And from there on, Adam, who was a prophet, because God, you see that God spoke to him directly, original human beings were all prophetic at that point. It's Adam and Eve, and also Cain, even though he did the first homicidal act, intentionally in the history of the human family experience. But with that being said, it's man and woman, blessed souls. Now, not man and man, not Adam and Steve, and I don't mean to be taking this matter lightly, and in no way do I think am I promoting any type of homophobic presentation, because it says here in Leviticus, the prohibition of homosexuality reads as follows in chapter 18, verse 22, "You shall not lie with a man as one lies with a woman. It is an abomination." However, what we see here, blessed souls, is there is no commandment, and I dare anyone who can show me, in the written scripture, and even for that matter, in in the oral tradition where you're supposed to hate someone whose sexuality, and I'm going to say this with all due respect, is dysfunctional to the continuance and in defiance of the continuance of the human family experience. With that being said as well, believe it or not, now this might shock a lot of people, you do not see the concept of lesbianism being forbidden strictly from the Bible. Now, I'm not promoting lesbianism. I also think it's equally dysfunctional to the human family experience. With that being said as well, it is not something which is promoted by the Torah. It just we should be aware of the fact that lesbianism is not strictly forbidden as a Torah prohibition. But with that being said as well, nor are we going to promote vigilantism against the experience of a man lying with a man or a woman lying with a woman, primarily because from the oral Torah traditions, basically it's almost impossible to convict them of this transgression. Number one, first of all, these activities are taking place behind closed doors. As it relates to, say, if it was an Israelite homosexual man and an Israelite homosexual man, they would have to be forewarned and warned of the consequences, and then if they act in open defiance, and they were warned, I think, at least two times, but those who are considered to be proper witnesses to an act which is dysfunctional, as I've mentioned before, to the human family experience, to the continuance of the human family experience, then only then could they be prosecuted and be given the death penalty. However, with that being said, we cannot enforce the death penalty today. So, in light of recent events, we're not promoting hatred. We are just promoting the idea for those who choose to make that decision, to have that form of sexuality which they feel comfortable with, please do not parade your sexuality in public. Just as those of us who are heterosexual, we should not be parading our sexuality in public. I'm not saying for the Noahides that they should refrain from kissing and hugging their partners in public. I, as an Israelite man, do not do it because I'm following halacha, Jewish law. There's no prohibition as far as I know. Maybe Ron can comment on that. If Noahides are allowed to kiss or embrace in public, especially man and wife or relatives. But that's just my take on the matter. The main thing, again, is to remind us all, blessed souls, that woman is the mother of our life because of her very nature to give life to her children. And if the woman in the feminine mode is giving life to all children, the whole purpose of creation is being fulfilled, and therefore all the produce comes in its proper time, and the rains come in the proper time, and that, of course, hopefully the proper conduct between the mother and the children and the mother, and the children with their friends and family and husband, wife, and there's various scenarios. I've said a mouthful, and I'm going to turn the ball over to Dennis, and then we'll let Ron respond.
We all know what God put in the Garden of Eden. He put one man, one woman. And he said, go forth and multiply is the word that's been turned over and over to generation and generation. We must do that for the expansion or the preservation of the species, which we are humans. And therefore, we need procreation. However, part of the human condition is peace and love, or love and peace. Included in that is the word friendship. We develop friendships with other humans. We develop it with animals. Humans are sentients. We depend on our senses. They must be there. We don't turn them off and on. So if anybody wants to have a relationship called friendship, so be it. That doesn't go against any real nature. But if you think it replaces go forth and multiply, they are talking about something a little different. So I don't mind strong friendships between anybody and anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's human nature. But human nature also says to go forth and multiply, that's a little different situation. So let's not confuse the political and the social values of what is better or what is worse, when in effect, common sense should prevail.
Ron, before you make your fuller comment on the totality of the issue we're talking about, are Noahides, say, a man and a woman, are they, I don't, as far as I know, they're not, there's no forbidden, that they're allowed to hug or kiss each other in public. I mean, they're husband and wife. I don't know how it relates to single people, but certainly I don't think the observance of the Seven-Eye Commandments is to try to introduce some sort of distortion of that Puritanism spirit, which was very, very, persecutory. It was involved in persecuting people for the slightest distortions and observations of consciousness that took place in this country almost 400 years ago.
I haven't come across any explanations of the commandment concerning sexual relations in the Shiva Mitzvah of Noah, concerning this explicit display of affections in public, except it falls under the recommendation of modesty, in which, you know, everything has its time and place, and as a result, you know, overexpression of intimacy in public would not be advised.
I walk in the street. I don't walk around with dark sunglasses like a blind man. You will see people getting affectionate, and I have a thought that, hey, I hope it's like that in their private moments, and may it cause them to grow and not just, you know, reach for the flesh. I mean, you know, flesh, all flesh will fade. As Dennis mentioned before, we all are going to pass on, and hopefully all forms of intimacy should be for empowerment, but just for display, I think there's something. I mean, the question is, you know, person, basically most people can only be one with another person any one moment, unless they want to get into some sort of freaky stuff, which we're not going to get into. But, you know, focus should be on one-on-one interaction, not am I looking over his shoulder, or is she looking over my shoulder to see who's watching me or, you know, him or her doing what they're doing. You know, I don't like to talk so much about sexuality, but this, we do see that in the Torah, especially with Adam and Eve, that it openly expresses that they were intimate with each other, but they were all alone. You know, it's no concern that if animals were in the proximity, or the bugs, or the leaves, or the trees, but they were alone. But, Ron, getting back to this idea of you know, why it had to be, why the Almighty said man and woman, not man and man, woman and woman, I look at it as a matter of symmetry. The man can offer only what a man can offer, and a woman can only offer what a woman can offer. Therefore, they become one whole, and there are various spiritual systems which talk about the bringing together of opposites creates a greater whole, a greater sense of consciousness. And we have a tradition in Israel, the right man for the one woman is actually blending together two aspects of one soul. Your comments on this matter.
Okay, I am going... If you bear with me, I'll read a small portion of The Path of the Righteous Gentile by Rabbi Chaim Chorfin and Rabbi Yaakov Rogalski, dealing with chapter 8, sexual relations. It is written, therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother, and he shall cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Genesis 2, verse 24. According to the Holy Scripture, this verse comes to teach, to instruct mankind concerning forbidden relationships. Rashi comments on that this phrase, therefore man shall leave his father and mother, his mother, forbids man to have sexual relations with the wife of his father, not his, the wife of his father, not his mother, even after death, that means his stepmother.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this also includes his natural mother. The phrase, cling to his wife, comes to teach us that he should have relations with his own wife, not another man's wife. To his wife comes to teach us that he should have relations with the opposite sex, not the male. And they shall become one flesh, comes to teach us that any exclude animals, for an animal is not of one flesh with a man, with a human.
Mm-hmm.
That's
beautiful.
It.
Jen? Yeah, I'm sorry.
I'd like to get back to the public, non-public idea. because it concerns personal and non-personal things.
Right.
We as humans don't go to the bathroom out in the open in full view of everybody. Why? It's personal, and it's not the best thing to look at in the human from humans' behavior. And yet, we tell little kids, don't pick your nose in public. Now, why do we do these things? Because it's personal. You cannot change the common sense world of what is public, non-public, personal, and non-personal. We want a little decorum. It's called the quality of life. If you don't know the difference, then maybe you should go into the desert or up a mountain someplace. Because we humans have a certain regard for each other, and it's not unlimited.
True. Ron, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to pick up Dennis on a phrase that he mentioned, quality of life, and it's been, you know, propagated tremendously recently in the media, and especially here in New York City, of our quality of life. And how we're constantly trying to beautify the city. I don't know if either of you have been into the city recently, but many of the streets have been made basically into promenades. They're no longer accessible by cars. So we're trying to increase the quality of life, but yet all the things which Dennis rightfully mentioned does not enhance our quality of life have never been addressed. It's gotten to the point where in the city right now, you know, kissing and holding hands, you know, of the same sex have been, you know, blatantly displayed as a badge of freedom. So,
yeah. I mean, I personally think it, you know, again, as someone who is not African American or African diasporic, that it would be insulting to me that to equivocate the oppression of homosexuality. And again, I do not promote. I don't believe in the oppression of anyone just because of their sexuality, whether it be healthy or otherwise. I do not think that it is fair to the African diasporic experience to equivocate what homosexuals have undergone or lesbians to the African diasporic slavery experience, which is now, thank God, a post-slavery experience, although there's still what to rectify among those who are the end, you know, whatever. We know things have to be fixed. Things have to be upgraded. With that being said, gentlemen, Dennis, I'll leave you to make a closing comment, and then Ron, and then we're going to close segue with some music.
I'd like to make a comment on race. There's only one race.
Yeah.
It's called the human race. God created it, and we must honor it. For those people who think they belong to a different race, they must... We are all children of God.
Amen. Ron? Final comments.
No comments at this time.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Unfortunately, I'm at the defect here of putting together what to say. I'm sorry.
No problem. I just want to mention as well, if you look in the Torah, actually the only mention of race, it has nothing to do with a nation or a race of people, but actually running a race. the only thing from what I recall in the book of Genesis, again, the nations of the earth are called Ka Mishpachat Adamah, all the families of the earth. Hence, that is the source of you hearing me frequently, and I never tire of saying it, blessed souls, the human family experience. That being said, blessed souls, I want to thank profusely for their time and effort, which is their sweat and toil of their mind and their heart, their psyche and their soul, Dennis Ryan and Ron Williams. This is Don Zosio Goodman wishing everyone a pleasant week. We're going to end off with a song by Ari Goldwag, Rabbi Ari Goldwag, finally here, talking about if we really want Mashiach, the Messiah, to come, we all have to be insincere. And it's a matter of, I should say, sincere, God forbid, not insincere, but we should all be very sincere about wanting to come, because we want to see the glory of the Most High above all things in a way that will be so accessible to the human family experience that we all can live in a way of Ahava Chad, one love, Goral Chad, one destiny, Kolano for all of us, but Darchi Shalom, in a peaceful way, Darchinim, in a pleasant way. And one of the ways we can experience it right now is for this moment, and see if we can take it to the next moment to remove the hatred from our hearts, remove the jealousy from our hearts, and to only get involved in self-competition, to compete about ourselves. How can we do better to do more goodness in the world? And hopefully this will be the fitting vessel to bring about the true and complete redemption. B'kar v'yemeinu, speed in our days. Is Ari Goldberg finally here? Thank you, everyone. Take care, everyone. And remember, you're good, because the Teva Tov Lehetiv, the Most High, created you with a divine image to help you get up from scrimmage to experience the sweetness of life without strife. But it doesn't come as a freebie. We have to sweat and toil to make it a better world. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.